So, good evening, everybody. I guess this is the third installment of this series that we're doing on Dogen's instructions to the cook. So, I see one or two or three people who haven't been here for the first two. So, I will say that Dogen was the founder of our particular stream of Zen. He brought it from China to Japan in the 13th century, and he founded the first Soto Zen monastery in Japan and wrote instructions to the Zen cook. And that's the text that we're studying. He gives very detailed descriptions of how to plan the meals, prepare the meals, how to handle the pots and pans and utensils, and how to wash rice. Those of you who were here heard his very detailed instructions about how to wash rice. And this might seem, you know, like why would we read a medieval Japanese text about how to wash rice? But this way of mindful cooking, paying scrupulous attention to our actions and pouring all of our energy into those actions, kind of serves as a template. And Dogen was well aware of this as he wrote his instructions to the cook, a template for the way we can do other activities in our daily life. In the sections we read in the first 2 weeks, Dogen takes us through the day of a cook in a Zen monastery who is called the Tenzo. So if I use that word, you'll know. The Tenzo. Giving instructions as he goes, takes us through the day. And the very last lines where we left off last week were where he talks about making the best possible use of the ingredients, whether they're poor ingredients or good ingredients, not to discriminate and just accept what's there and make the best possible food from it, which we can certainly apply to our lives. You know, we're given certain raw materials. We might not always be pleased with the raw materials we have, or whatever, our family background, our genetics, our the way our livelihood works out, but we take those materials and use them with dignity and make the best we can from those materials. And then he talks about putting everything away all the tools away in their proper places. And then he says, as I said, being scrupulous in our actions, pouring our energy into those actions, we must aspire to the highest ideals without becoming arrogant in our manner. Oh, I didn't. I'm going to pause.
Truly just a matter of course. Yet we remain unclear about them because our minds go racing about like horses running wild in the field, while our emotions remain unmanageable like monkeys swinging in the trees. If only we would step back to carefully reflect on the horse and monkey, our lives would naturally become one with our work. Doing so is the means whereby we turn things even while simultaneously we are being turned by them. It is vital that we clarify and harmonize our lives with our work and not lose sight of either the absolute or the practical.
Great, thank you. So I'm pretty sure that all of us are familiar with the mind that runs around like a wild horse. Mm-hmm. Or jumps around like a monkey. But Dogen urges us to take a backward step, and as he says elsewhere, turn the light inward to illuminate the self. So even as that monkey jumps around in our mind as we sit, we turn the light inward. And just shine the light of awareness. We don't have to scold the monkey or chain the monkey down anything like that. But just shine that light of awareness on and look deeply into the nature of that wild horse, that monkey. And when we do that, somehow the distractions of the mind begin to drop away. Just through that exercise of being aware. Instead of constantly trying to manipulate, narrate, or evaluate our own experience, we are simply fully present in each moment of our work or whatever we're doing. We turn things while simultaneously being turned by them. Elsewhere, Dogen says, the self turns the Dharma and the Dharma turns the self. So what he means is that we are always influencing the world, and the world's always influencing us. We're always functioning in relationship to the world around us. Pretty obvious, and yet we tend to think of it being us versus the world, or that somehow we should be in control of it all. So when we harmonize ourselves with our work, we don't lose sight of the absolute unity of all things or of the particularity of each thing. That's what he's saying in that last line. Not lose sight of either the absolute or the practical. So let's look a little further about how that works. Next paragraph, please.
Handle even a single leaf of a green in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha. This in turn allows the Buddha to manifest through the leaf. This is the power which you cannot grasp with your rational mind. It operates freely, according to the situation, in a most natural way. At the same time, this power functions in our lives to clarify and settle activities, and is beneficial to all living things.
Okay, thank you. So Dogen is asking us to treat even a single leaf of spinach or kale so that it manifests its full potential. There's an old Zen story about this. Michael told it at the day retreat out at our place in June. But I don't think anyone here was there. Yes, you both were. I stand corrected. And you'll remember the story, I think. So a monk was traveling in China long ago on pilgrimage looking for a good temple to practice at. And he stopped to rest by a stream. He was getting close to a temple he wanted to check out. And he saw a single leaf of some kind of, maybe it was, bok choy or something, floating down the stream, and he thought, oh, I don't want to practice at a temple where they waste food like that. That's terrible. And then he saw a single monk running down the stream as fast as he could and jumped into the edge of the stream and grabbed up the leaf. And the traveling monk thought, ah, that's where I want to go. And one of the participants in that retreat where Michael told the story said, you know, I always feel like I'm the guy who's running after that leaf. You know, this makes me feel better. So what if we treated people in the same way? so that they manifest the body of the Buddha. So that even just, you know, a single ordinary person, we see as Buddha. When, if we treat people in that way, so that they manifest the body of the Buddha, this in turn allows the Buddha to manifest through them, just like the leaf, right? It's not so easy with people sometimes, is it? Kind of easier with vegetables almost. But of course we all know ourselves how we appreciate being treated with care and respect, and how we are more likely to respond in kind when we are, right? Have you ever noticed how others respond when you treat them as you want to be treated? An old Zen friend of ours in Seattle got in touch about a year ago. He was going through some pretty harsh cancer treatment, and he wanted to reconnect to his Zen practice. And so I did phone conversations, phone doksan, with him about every 2 or 3 weeks for about over 6 months. He died when we were in Japan. One thing that he shared with me was, you know, going through, you know, how dehumanizing it can be going through treatment in the hospital system. Everything's so high tech, people are stressed, you know, the staff are stressed. And so he decided he would make it his practice to make eye contact with each person who gave him some kind of care or that he dealt with, and use their name, because they have their name tags, even if they weren't using his name or making eye contact with him. And he said a number of times the whole interaction really shifted when he did that, when he saw these, you know, caregivers as people. They saw him as a full person, not just as a sick guy getting chemo. So that's what Dogen's talking about here, I think. Not just, you know, a leaf of bok choy. So Kevin, could you read the next... let's see, we are on page 8 and the second paragraph, after all.
After all the preparations for the meal are complete, clean up thoroughly, putting everything back where it ought to be. When the drum sounds and the bell rings both morning and evening, be sure not to miss Zazen nor going to see the master to receive his teaching.
Okay, that's good. Even with all these tremendous duties that the Tenzo has, as we've been hearing over the past couple weeks earlier in the text, Dogen's saying he must not neglect his Zazen practice or going for Doksan with the teacher. I think, again, it sort of harkens back to that line where he said, you know, we must aspire to the highest of ideals without becoming arrogant in our manner. I think he's cautioning against getting caught up in some kind of self-important professionalism or specialization, maybe. You know, well, I'm a Tenzo, so I don't need to. You know, we have that tendency, don't we, sometimes. Rimmick, next paragraph.
When you know the exact number in the community...
Oh, wait a minute. One back.
When you return
Thanks.
To your room, shut your eyes and count the number of people in the soto. Do not forget the elder priests and retired monks, plus those living in single rooms. Include those in the infirmary or any other elderly people. In addition to these, any monks who are on leave and others who may have just arrived but are not yet living fully within the community should be taken into account. And finally, those living in any of the sub-temples within the complex must be added. If there are any doubts, check with the heads of the offices or those in charge of the various residencies where people might be staying.
Okay, thanks. And actually, David, could you read the next paragraph too, and then we'll pause.
When you know the exact number in the community, then calculate the amount of food to be cooked. For every grain of rice to be eaten, supply one grain. In dividing one grain, the result may be 2 half grains, or possibly 3 or 4. On the other hand, one grain might equal 1/2 grain, or perhaps 2 half grains. Then again, 2 half grains might be counted as a whole grain. You must be able to see clearly how much of a surplus will be created if you add 1 unit of rice, whether there will be enough if you take away 1 unit.
Okay, thank you. So he's describing, you know, a large monastery here with hundreds of monks in training. So it's not an easy task to calculate how much rice to cook. I mean, rice being the staple, of course. And in the second paragraph, with all that one grain, half grain business, I think what he's talking about is saying you can't just use a standard formula, right? Anyone who's cooked for large groups knows that it can be kind of elusive how much you actually need. Sometimes you need to make more or less depending on various conditions, such as hot or cold weather, the age of the monks, how much physical work they might be doing. Or sometimes you have to stretch, you only have a smaller amount, and you have to make it go further. So that's what he's doing with those fine calculations. At the retreat this past weekend, at Sea to Sky Retreat Center, where several of us were, did you notice the first day that we kind of ran out of oatmeal the first morning?
Seriously ran out of
oatmeal. And I, you know, excuse me, the people at the end are not going to get any. Fortunately, he had made quite a bit of rice cereal for the gluten-free people, so he brought some rice cereal to the ends of the tables. But Michael checked with him afterwards and realized we were eating Zen style with our 3 bowls, you know, oatmeal, fruit, and some yogurt in the 3 bowls. And he used his usual formula for groups, which for how much oatmeal to make for that many people, not taking into consideration that they usually serve eggs and toast as well. Mm-hmm. And so we ate much more oatmeal than, so there was plenty the next 2 days. So no fixed formula. You have to use the formula and then be able to stretch or adapt, is what he's saying. Okay, Bo, could you read the next?
When you eat a grain of luling rice, you may become the monk Gushan. When you add a grain, you may become the cow. Sometimes the cow eats Gushan. Sometimes Gushan pastures the cow.
Okay, that's good. So what do you make of that? That's probably completely incomprehensible without making some efforts to decode it. So we'll get some help from Uchiyama Roshi's commentary on this text. Dogen is making references to 2 koans, 2 old Zen stories, that would have been well known to people of his time, to his readers at the time. The first reference is to Luling Rice. Luling is just a place name, as far as I know, with no particular significance. The koan goes like this. A monk asked a Zen master, "What is the essence of Buddha Dharma?" meaning the teachings of the Buddha. The Zen master replied, "What is the current price of rice from Luling?" in Luling. Does that clarify things?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, there are many koans that follow that kind of pattern. What is the essence of the Buddha Dharma? Another way it's asked is, why did Bodhidharma come from the east? Bodhidharma was the Indian or Northern Indian monk who brought Zen practice to China. So it's asking why, you know, why did he come to China? What was he bringing? What was the essence? So that's a very common question. And often the answers sound quite nonsensical. A pound of flax, or, you know, they're very odd. This one, but often with some context from Chinese culture in the 8th to 10th century, then we can understand the reference. So in this case, the reference is to the price of rice in Luling, actually is referring to the core Buddhist teaching of impermanence, because the price of rice fluctuates, right? According to supply and demand, according to whether there's a bumper crop or a crop failure. So the price of rice in Luling is impermanence. So how would we update that to the 21st century? What would you say?
What is the price of gas?
Yeah. In Vancouver these days. Exactly. Fluctuates according to many causes and conditions, right? Yeah. So the other reference is a little trickier. It's to another old Zen story about Guishan and the cow. So one day Guishan said to his monks, 100 years after my death, I will be reborn as a cow belonging to a parishioner living at the foot of this mountain. On the right flank of the cow will be written, I am Guishan. Probably kind of a spotted cow, you know, looks a little bit like a Chinese character. And if you say it is just a cow, you are wrong. Oh, sorry, back up. If you say the cow is me, you are wrong because it's just a cow. And if you say it's just a cow, you are wrong because it will be me. So what should you say? That's the koan. So Uchiyama Roshi interprets this story as a representation of the relative and the absolute. We keep talking about these two truths in Buddhist thought, right? The relative being our particularity, right? The everyday world of you and me, right and wrong. High and low. And the absolute, the realm of infinite connection, not separate, nothing separate, unity, and those not being two different things, those being simultaneous. Interpenetrating aspects of reality. So, sometimes it's hard. So he's kind of saying he's going to be reincarnated as a cow, right? And it's a little hard sometimes to reconcile a kind of literal view of reincarnation with the Buddhist teaching of non-self. If there is no separate self, what's reincarnated? And the Buddha himself was very careful not to be pinned down on that question, actually. He would say things like, well, actually, you wouldn't understand if I told you. Mm-hmm. It's vast. It's beyond beyond speech, the true vastness of our being. But then when you think, as the last weekend when we were at we were up at the Sea to Sky retreat center in the forest, we did a kind of reflection on the elements, meditation on the elements of earth, water, fire, and air, and reflected that every molecule in our body, every molecule of water or mineral that gives us form, the very air that we breathe has passed through countless other beings, right? We are made up of countless other beings. So in another sense, we are very literally reincarnated or recycled. We're just a big bag of recycling. But not reincarnated as a discrete self, right? So Guishan is quite right when he says, if you say the cow is me, you are wrong, because it is just a cow. And he's also right when he says, if you say it's a cow, you are wrong, because it will be me. So Dogen says, when you eat a grain of rice, of Luling rice, you may become the monk Guishan. Right? When you see deeply into impermanence, you will be Guishan. Then he says, when you add a grain, you may become the cow. And the cow here is the relative, the body. And Guishan is the absolute here in his, the way he's looking at this. And I'm just going to read to you a little bit. From Uchiyama Roshi. He says, what then is this body? Truly, it is neither an entity that is fixed, nor it is something, nor is it something undefined. If you eat food in order to do zazen, that is food for zazen. If you eat food in order to steal, it is just food for sustaining a thief. To the extent that you do zazen with your body, the cow eats guishan. Body, according to practice. You are mistaken if you think it is best to throw away your body, in this case the cow, because you think it has no value, and just practice zazen, that is guishan. So don't dismiss the body. Don't think that somehow you do zazen, that doing zazen is something you do up here, you know, or up here, like your mind somehow up here. He says, our zazen becomes the Buddha Dharma precisely when it is functioning as this body in our daily life. There will always be that complaining and unsatisfied aspect of the self with which we have to deal. The restless monkey, the horse kicking, the stubborn cow. Right? There will always be that unsatisfied aspect of the self with which we have to deal. The Dharma is not going to become manifest only after we have somehow brought this aspect under control or stamped it out. The function of the Dharma and of Zazen is to care for the obstreperous aspect of ourself in the same way a mother lulls her baby to sleep. In other words, Guishan pastures the cow. That reminded me of one of my favorite passages from Suzuki Roshi, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, about dealing with our inner cow or ox. You may have you ever seen the series of pictures, they're called the Zen Ox Herding pictures, the little ox herding person, mostly it's a boy. But I have pictures at home with where it's a female ox herding person, struggling with the ox, and then the ox being, you know, our embodied stubborn animal self. In fact, we should do a series actually of talks on the ox herding pictures sometime, illustrated. So this is what Suzuki Roshi has to say. About trying to control, about our urge to control, whether it's our inner monkey or ox or other people. He starts with other people. Even though you try to put people under some control, it is impossible. Have you ever tried it? You cannot do it. The best way to control people is to encourage them to be mischievous. Then they will be in control in the wider sense. To give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow is the way to control him. So it is with people. First let them do what they want, and watch them. This is the best policy. To ignore them is not good. That is the worst policy. The second worst is trying to control them. The best one is to watch them, just to watch them, without trying to control them. The same way works for yourself as well. If you want to attain perfect calmness in your zazen, you should not be bothered by the various images you find in your mind. Let them come and let them go. Then they will be under control. But this policy is not so easy. It sounds easy, but it requires some special effort. How to make this kind of effort is the secret of practice. Suppose you are sitting under some extraordinary circumstances. If you try to calm your mind, you will be unable to sit. And if you try not to be disturbed, your effort will not be the right effort. Probably every one of us at some point has been sitting with some level of inner turmoil, right? And if you try and control it, it doesn't really work. So where is the way of right effort? He says the only effort that will help you is to count your breathing or to concentrate on inhaling and exhaling. We say concentration, but to concentrate your mind on something is not the true purpose of Zen. The true purpose is to see things as they are, to observe things as they are, and to let everything go as it goes. This is to put everything under control in its widest sense. The Zen practice is to open up our small mind. So concentrating is just an aid to help you realize big mind, or the mind that is everything. So that's Suzuki Roshi's take on both sitting and living with our inner ox, or cow, or monkey. That's really the core of this section. So there's like three more paragraphs that are really kind of self-explanatory, and not too much to comment on in them. So instead of going over them, I want to leave us some time to talk about this passage we just read. So I'm going to stop now.